Well, thank you. It's good to be back. First of all, I want to thank all those of you that helped with the outreach events we did at Christ Church of the Valley. We had over 30 volunteers show up for those events, and it was phenomenally successful, both on Saturday and Sunday, and then the Thursday night event we did as well. So those of you that have helped out, again, thank you. You really made the difference there. I also want to thank all of you who prayed for my son Joel. This past week he did his testimony in court, and it only took 4 hours. So, well, there are three defense attorneys, so they all had a chance to cross-examine him, but he did really well. The defense attorneys really tried to trip him up and try to get him to alter his testimony, but he really stood firm, and the DA was quite pleased. So, and he's done. He's not going to have to go back in. So he's really glad to have that behind him and get on with life. I mean, it's been 4 years since the incident, so he says his life has kind of been put on hold during that time. And also, you know, Kathy and I attended a couple of days of the trial and just learned just the degree to which God was working in our son's life. Because those of you who don't know, he was brutally stabbed October 26th in 2008. Anyways, it just so happens there was an off-duty paramedic that treated my son that we just found out about the court trial. We had no idea that the moment he got stabbed, he stepped in there and staunched the blood flow. And if it wasn't for him happening to be there, our son wouldn't have made it. And the other thing we learned is that a traumatologist, when they heard that our son was being brought in an ambulance, they immediately called this traumatologist, woke him out of bed, and told him to get to the hospital right away. And somehow they knew that he was the only doctor that could really save our son. He got there within 5 minutes. He was there when our son arrived, and he just testified to exactly what he had to do to save our son. And the bottom line, too, is our son was really worried that these guys might get a light sentence. The DA says just for the crimes that they committed that night, they're looking at 60 years each. And he says, moreover, they've been committing crimes while they've been in prison, including violent crimes. So he says they're going to be, those charges will be added up. And he said there's also charges of crimes they committed before that night. So he says, don't worry, your son's got nothing to worry about. These people will not be getting out of the incarceration system. So that was a real great relief to our son. But again, both Kathy and I want to thank you for praying, because it was definitely a traumatic time for our son. Just says the worst part was anticipating the trial. Once it actually got going, and it says, you know, so literally for 4 years he's been kind of on pins and needles wondering what's been going on. And we also found out that what was really causing him trauma is that 3 years ago he got this phone call where he was being grilled over the phone by what he thought was a DA. Turned out it was one of the defense attorneys trying to get him to alter his testimony. And he says, Dad, that gal really wore me down. Kept him on the phone for nearly an hour. But he was relieved to discover everything he said in that phone call was not admissible because she never announced who she was. So that was a great relief to our son because he was worried that what he told the DA might have actually been a problem. The DA says, don't worry about it. She can't use any of that. Because of the way she got the information. So, anyway, again, thanks for your prayers. It's just a relief for both Kathy and me and for Joel that this is now all behind us. So, as to where I've been the last couple of weeks, did speak at Christ Church of the Valley, but also this past Sunday I was in Charlotte, North Carolina, and there we were teaching a class. Now, it's interesting about Southern Evangelical Seminary. They've had us come before to teach these intensive classes. And I mean, they're intense. You're there for a week, and you kind of jam in 30 to 40 hours of teaching in a single week. It's exhausting for the students and exhausting for the professor. I can share that with you. But previously, we've been teaching classes, kind of an introduction to science apologetics. Anyway, they were so happy what we did that they've asked us to come back and teach classes where we do one discipline at a time. So our staff biochemist has been there already teaching a week-long course on apologetics that you get from biochemistry. And so Jeff Swearink and I have just, well, Jeff is there right now teaching a class on, and he just finished up last night, teaching a class on astronomy and apologetics. So I did the first half, he's doing the second half, and then Fuzz, Jeff, and I are going back for the National Apologetics Conference, which will be this next coming weekend. But it's something I saw at Christ Church of the Valley, is that something that we've become aware of at Reasons to Believe is the degree to which the Church of Jesus Christ uses their weakest evidences to demonstrate the existence of God and not their strongest evidences. And so we kind of shared that with the seminary students at Southern Evangelical Seminary. And they said, you're absolutely right. We've been getting all these classes on apologetics and we're being taught the weak arguments, not the strong arguments. And we also had a very interesting discussion as to why that happens. And the problem with the strongest evidences for the Christian faith, and not with the strongest scientific evidences, obviously the church is united in using the historical evidence for the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead. You're united in terms of how you can use the Bible to show that it has authority and historical apologetics of fulfilled prophecy. But there's a real reluctance within the church to use the scientific evidences. And, you know, what I appreciate about Southern Evangelical Seminary is they now understand that if our goal is to reach adults who have not had exposure to the church and Christianity, you have to use science. Because you can talk to them about historical apologetics, they're not interested in that. Or philosophical apologetics, they're not interested in that. They want to hear about the science. And so they're becoming aware, and it's taken many years for them to become aware that they have to use science if they have any hope of reaching American non-Christian adults. And for that matter, college professors and students as well. So we are forming a partnership with them, but now I think they really appreciate what we have to offer. But also I had a time to meet with the faculty addressing this question, why the church is reluctant to use their strongest scientific evidence for the Christian faith. And it's because they're afraid of division. They're worried that these strong evidences are going to bring internal divisions or make people in the church uncomfortable, and especially make people uncomfortable about the fact that they're not sharing their faith. But what we came up with is that, you know, that kind of discomfort is actually good for people that are in church, and we need to help them feel a little more uncomfortable. And so how can we get into the church with these strong evidences? But I think that's one thing we saw at Christ Church of the Valley. When you have the opportunity, I think it was thrilling for us as the pastoral staff at Christ Church of the Valley, we're not worried about what these strong evidences would do. I said, you know, if this is going to have an impact on helping us reach our community for Christ, we're not going to be concerned about how this might disturb a few individuals inside the church. Let's go for it. And what they discovered is we got one complaint out of the 4,500 people that attended the events. Just one out of 4,500. And so, you know, we've been worrying about nothing. So, and, you know, people are just so thrilled to discover that these strong evidences exist. And I think that's a passion we're discovering and Reasons to Believe, is how many people in the church, serious Christians, aren't even aware these evidences exist. So let's stop worrying about the theistic evolutionists. Let's stop worrying about the young earth creationists. Let's stop worrying about the framework hypothesis folks, and let's give people the best evidences that we have for the Christian faith. So not every church is open to that, but we're committed to work with those churches and those seminaries that are, or discovering is, those are the churches that have a heart and a passion to reach unchurched adults for Christ. And what better churches for us to partner with and seminaries for us to partner with at Reasons to Believe. So that's kind of what we're going to be doing, restructuring our outreach to really offer our services to those churches and seminaries who have that commitment to seriously reach out to unchurched adults. So that's a quick update on what's happening there. And it's been months since I've given you a new scientific discovery, so I brought one with me this morning. And it's from this journal, Astral Biology. I've been subscribing to this journal ever since it first was launched about 10 years ago. But they have a very interesting article in here written by, let me see if I can find it here for you. Yeah, here we go. The title is Travel, Sex, and Food. What Speciation Got to Do with It? And it's written by six astrobiologists. But what I found fascinating is the first time I've ever seen a research paper seriously address the question, why does planet Earth have so many different species of life? And by the way, when they talk about sex, all they're talking about is bacterial sex. And it's horizontal gene transfer. You know, these are bacteria that really don't have sexual reproduction, but the claim is they got something somewhat equivalent to it through horizontal gene transfer.
More sex than I've had.
Well, I'll let that one go. I think we heard something about wisdom in the church service today. So. But what they've done is they targeted a desert oasis in Texas, and it's called, excuse my pronunciation, I never learned Spanish in school. Since I was raised in Canada, they had me study French and German. But I think it's Cuatro Ciénagas Basin, and apparently it's a very large desert oasis in central Mexico. And what's interesting about this oasis for these six astrobiologists, it's a place that has amazingly diverse number of species, given the fact that it's kind of a habitat that's on the edge of survivability for these species. This particular desert oasis has an extremely low phosphorus availability, and phosphorus is kind of the key ingredient for all life. I mean, I've shared with you before one reason why we have life on planet Earth. Our planet has four times as much phosphorus as any other body we know of in the universe. And it's because we live in such a phosphorus-rich planet that you can actually have DNA and RNA. The backbone of both the DNA and the RNA molecule is phosphorus. But this is a place where the phosphorus quantity or abundance is a lot less than what we see elsewhere on the planet. But it's also a place that has very interesting nutrient recycling. And it's a place where the different species actually are symbiotically supporting one another. And then there's geographic isolation. I mean, just all you got to do is go meters away from the oasis and you got a completely different habitat zone. So the whole point is that we observe a lot of, quote, speciation events through geographic isolation. And I put speciation in quotes because often what's happening is you get a bird species that gets geographically separated, and so you have one group of a bird species living in a different geographic zone than another, and they adapt to the food supply there, and then they refuse to mate with one another. And so biologists will identify them as a speciation event where one species became two. It just shows you how many different definitions of species exist in the biological literature. By many biologists' definition, that's not a speciation event. Why? Because if you bring the two species back together into a common habitat, given them enough time, they will reproduce one another, and you basically wind up with the same species you started with. But what caught my attention is that they noted that the microbes that exist in this Cuatro Ciénagas Basin demonstrate the highest rates of evolution that they've seen anywhere on the planet. And they get the evolution through horizontal gene transfer. And what that is, that's where you get two different bacterial species where a little piece of the genome of one bacteria will be transferred to the genome of another bacteria. Now, not all species can do that. But bacteria, particularly the more primitive bacteria, are able to do that. And that's one way they're, quote, able to evolve. And the other thing they noted about the microbes in this particular desert oasis is that they demonstrate the greatest food and nutrient plasticity. You say, what does that mean? That means they're not fussy about what they eat. And so they can easily adapt from one food supply in their habitat to a completely different food supply in their habitat. Now think of a cockroach. A cockroach really isn't very fussy about what it eats. And the nutrient plasticity means that they're not that sensitive to changes of the nutrients in the environment. So if the nutrients change, they're quite able to adapt to that. And they also show the highest facility for geographic travel. In other words, they show an amazing ability to move quickly from one habitat to a different habitat that could be separated by tens or hundreds of miles. After all, they're microbes. Microbes float up in the atmosphere. And so the bottom line is they identified this one region and the microbes that existed there as being the most aggressive evolvers on the planet. You're not going to find species of life that are capable of more efficient and more rapid naturalistic evolution than these species. And so these six astrobiologists, basically a proposal paper, they're not really reporting any experimental results, but they said we've done research studies at this particular desert oasis, and we've done studies on the microbes, and we're here to report these are the best laboratory examples we're going to find on the planet to do long-term evolution experiments. And so that's basically what they're proposing, is for teams of ecologists to go to this desert oasis and do long-term evolution experiments with the goal of trying to determine why does our planet Earth have so many species. And what they're hinting at in the paper here is that from a naturalistic perspective, our planet should not have as many species as it does. We have a huge number of species, which is a profound challenge to the naturalistic model, and their claim is, because they are naturalists, they do believe that there's a natural explanation for all these species. They say if we do these long-term evolution experiments at this desert oasis, we're going to find the missing piece of the puzzle as to why our planet has so many species. Now, I think what makes this paper particularly important is that it was published just months after another independent team actually determined the number of species here on planet Earth. I mean, those of you who have taken biology will have been taught by your professors or by your textbooks that, we really have no idea how many species of life are on the planet. Well, a research team for the first time back in, I think it was May of this year, published a result in what's called PLOS Biology. And you know what's fun about that? You can get the journal for free. It's an online journal, open access, which means you don't have to buy any of the articles. It's all publicly available to everybody. So you can go online and read the paper for yourself. Matter of fact, let me see if I can actually get the reference here for you. Here we go. And what happened here? I'm looking for the reference here. Sorry, I'll have to get that for you. Anyway, let me give you the numbers they came up with. 8.7 million plus or minus 1.3. So if you're looking for a really accurate number, they don't have it yet. But keep in mind, the best numbers we had until they published their paper was plus or minus 1,000%. So this is a huge improvement. We're now down to about plus or minus 15%. It's 8.7 million plus or minus 1.3 million eukaryotic species. And so what about the prokaryotic species? There we only have an estimate that is between 100,000 and 10 million. But the prokaryotics, that's only the bacteria and the archaea. They're all unicellular life forms. They're unicellular life forms where the cells don't have a nucleus. And yeah, they're the most difficult species to try to uncover because They typically live deep underground or in the deep part of the ocean, and they're hard to find. But personally, I'm persuaded that it's probably closer to 100,000 than it is the 10 million, because bacteria can get into a lot of different places. But what they have done a very good job of determining the number of species made up of plants and unicellular life forms and animals that have cells with a nucleus in it. 8.7 million, plus or minus 1.3, where 6.5 million of them are land species and 2.2 million are marine species. And we've studied the land quite well. And this is really the challenge to the Darwinian paradigm. How is it that the continental land masses have 6.5 million species of relatively advanced life? Now, what they're proposing here at this desert oasis is to study the microbes. To be, it may be much more interesting to study the animals that are multicellular, but they're not going to do that. Nevertheless, and of course, one reason why they want to look at microbes, because in 20 years of microbial study, that's equivalent to 1 million years of human evolution. And so you can use these microbes as a proxy for much longer term evolution for advanced animals. And I've just written an article on this. It'll be released in probably a month, I would guess, where I kind of suggest what kind of experiments could be done to really put to the test creation evolution models. Because we know the planet is 6.5 million species of life in the continental land masses today. The continental land masses really didn't exist until about 3 billion years ago, and we know not much happened in the first 2 billion years. The greatest speciation activity for those 6.5 million species are literally in the last 575 million years. That's a lot of species to put upon the terrestrial scene, and of course we need to also put into account is how many species have disappeared. That 6.5 billion species of life on planet Earth today, or on the continental land masses today, is not the total number those continental land masses have sustained over the past 575 million years. So that number should be thrown into the mix. And then you want to be able to observe how rapidly these microbes are able to evolve. And what they're proposing to do here is to come in with teams and artificially alter the nutrient and food supply. So, and the whole idea is they know this isn't going to be natural, but they're saying what we're going to do is come in and put constraints in the environment. And you can do that because this is an isolated desert oasis. So it's actually possible, unlike other ecosystems, for humans to come in and manipulate the habitat, actually change the nutrient availability, the food supply availability, and then watch what happens. And the whole point is what we'll see will always be greater than what nature is able to do all by herself. And so this will be kind of putting a maximum limit on what evolution can do. And what they're going to try to do is measure the rate of changes taking place and the kind of changes taking place. But one thing I added in my piece is what also needs to be done is to take the constraints away and see how quickly these microbes revert back to their original state. Because this is what we've already seen, say, in the Galapagos Islands. And by the way, they mention here this is like a Galapagos Island opportunity to test evolutionary theories. But what we've seen in the Galapagos Islands, for example, is here's Charles Darwin going in for 5 years, and he sees the beaks of the finches getting longer and shorter or wider and narrower in response to changes of the food supply on the islands. Now we've been there for more than 150 years. And what we're observing is indeed the beaks do change, but they oscillate. They don't change in a linear fashion. Darwin assumed that the beaks were going to continue to get bigger and longer. In fact, what we see is they get wider, then narrower, wider and narrower, longer and shorter in response to the changing food supply and the climate of those different islands. So in the case of the desert oasis, the same thing needs to be done. To put the constraints in, see what changes take place, remove the constraints, and see what happens. Now, if it continues to go in a particular direction, then that would be evidence in favor of some kind of Darwinian paradigm. But if you see a reversion back to the original state, then that would be evidence in favor of divine creation. And of course, you also want to measure what kind of changes you're getting. And the point I make in my comment on this is that if you don't see changes, that would be consistent with a microbe becoming a complex, multicellular, multi-differentiated organism, then you really haven't proved the Darwinian point. If all you wind up is with microbes and the microbes have no potential to become anything other than microbes, then that is not evidence in favor of a naturalistic explanation for the history of life on planet Earth. But I do commend them because they're taking on the simplest problem, which is, can we even explain how you can get a whole lot of species in a hurry? And so I think this has got some real potential to really expose the problem, the fact that planet Earth has far too many species and far too great a diversity of species, even at the microbial level, to explain without invoking divine intervention. So, yes.
Have you seen the recent results? Obviously, that about 2 weeks ago, a ship that did a 70,000-mile cruise around the ocean taking water samples discovered thousands and thousands of new types of plankton. And the other discoveries, obviously, is finally scientists being able to get into a lot of closed countries in South Pacific, obviously, and again, finding ecosystems and just loads of species that we've never seen before, Laos, New Guinea. And I think our species count is way off, because I think we're really way undercounted in a lot of areas.
Well, the team that published this paper somewhere back in May in PLOS, they made that comment. Says, you know, we got a pretty good handle on the big stuff, the big plants and the big animals. Where we are in a real quandary is how many different species of the small organisms exist. And what they did is they took the different classification systems, which we all get in our biology classes. You know, you got the phyla, the family, the order, the genus, etc. And they said, you know, there's good reasons why biologists have developed this classification system. And they said, you know, trying to see the growth at the species level is difficult. But what they did is a very interesting statistical study. They said, you know, you could actually look at the different classification system. And you know, if you know how many different orders you have, you can get an estimate of how that will translate into species by looking at those parts of the plant and animal kingdom where we know we got a fairly complete count. And basically said we're going to use that as a way to calibrate what's going on for the different species of life where we're off by 1,000% in trying to come up with an estimate. So what they basically demonstrated is there's a consistency in the relationship between, say, the number of orders and family and the numbers of species and the genera that you get, and use those regions where we got good counts and extrapolate into those areas where we don't. And that's kind of where they came up with the 8.7 million. But they gave up on the prokaryotes, because there we simply don't have any idea or any really good idea of any kind of a classification system there. So that's still off by plus or minus 1,000%. Some say off by 10,000%. But in the case of the eukaryotes, they got it down to about plus or minus 15%. Yes.
I'm curious how they feel that they're accurate to that level of degree of accuracy, considering that's a huge improvement over the previous estimates. What justifies that degree of accuracy?
Well, they basically said nobody's ever really tried to take the data that we have and develop some kind of statistical analysis where we extrapolate from those species where we have good counts and good data to those where we don't. And mainly the main point of their paper is to demonstrate that there is indeed this relationship. Because there's a lot of criticism from biologists and say, you can't use this group of species to extrapolate to this group. And they said, we've actually done a test which shows that it works. And so given that it works, we think we have a number that's this accurate. Now, when they quoted their error bar about plus or minus 15%, it did come under some criticism. But what I noticed in reading the responses of the paper, there seems to be a consensus that, hey, maybe you can quibble and say it's plus or minus 20%, or maybe some have said it's actually better than plus or minus 15%, but it's a huge improvement over the plus or minus 1,000%. And nobody is saying that they're off by more than 50%. So, in that sense. But I mean, I think one reason why they got such a good result, they limited it to just the eukaryotes. I mean, by taking out the prokaryotes, that eliminated a lot of uncertainty. And basically, they're saying the prokaryotes are in a completely different category anyway. We're only looking there at life where the cells don't have a nucleus. Yes.
What's the difference between a prokaryote and a eukaryote?
The difference between a prokaryote and a eukaryote is the eukaryotes, the cells, have a nucleus with a membrane where the nucleus contains all the DNA. And actually, it's more complicated than that, because what you see in eukaryotes is you find inside the cell lots of little different structures that have enclosed membranes, whereas in the prokaryotes, it doesn't have a nucleus with any kind of a membrane that surrounds it.
So prokaryotes, you're talking really small.
They tend to be much smaller cells, and you know they're more primitive than their metabolic reactions, but they're still living organisms.
So is bacteria prokaryote or eukaryote?
Most bacteria are prokaryotes.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And they have DNA.
Yeah, they have DNA, but it's not organized like you see in eukaryotes, where the DNA is organized in the chromosomes, all encapsulated inside this nucleus, where there's actually a membrane around the nucleus. You know, that's the real difference. And so, yeah, it's you know, eukaryotes are at a far more complex level, and because of the way the cells are structured, it actually opens up the pathway for multicellular, multi-differentiated cells that can lead to advanced life. Evolutionists are convinced that prokaryotes aren't going to get there. But they, in fact, that's one of the big problems for the evolutionary paradigm. How do you start off with prokaryotes and get eukaryotes? I mean, that's a huge step, and no one's ever been able to answer, you know, how that step would take place through some naturalistic pathway. They just said it must have happened early on in the history of life on planet Earth, and once you've got the eukaryotes, then you can proceed to much more advanced life. Yes, in the back. That's a debate. Some people think they're alive, some people think they're not. And probably more biologists consider them not to be living than those that consider them to be living.
So are they count in their count?
No, they're not.
They're not considered?
Not. In fact, you'll see a number of articles we've written about viruses as to why God would create viruses. Turns out they play many critical roles in making possible advanced life here on planet Earth. Matter of fact, when we finish with Psalm 139, or by the way, we're almost done. Might even be able to finish today. We're going to move on to Psalm 147 and 148. And you might want to read Psalm 147 and 148 in preparation for our next jumping off point. But one of the things you're going to see in Psalm 147 and 148 is that viruses play a critical role in making possible the complex precipitation patterns that enable advanced life to exist in the continental of the land masses and enable you to have 6.5 million species of life on the continents. You're not going to get those 6.5 million species unless you find some way to organize the water cycle as we see described in Psalm 147 and 148. I mean, we not only live in a planet that's got liquid water on its surface, we live in a planet that has precipitation falling out of the sky on the continent of the land masses in six different forms. You're wondering what that is? Read Psalm 147, 48, and tell me what those six different forms of precipitation are. People call it rain. Hey, the Bible says it's not just rain. There's other forms as well. Yes?
I wanted to ask you, is there a reason why they messed out species that are not on the continent?
That are not in the continent? No. This particular study that was published in PLOS, mm-hmm. they did count those in the oceans. 2.2 million in the oceans, 6.5 million on account of the land masses. Put the two together, that gets you your 8.7 million.
Okay.
And so, yeah, we're looking at three times as many species on the continents as we are in the oceans. And yet the oceans are three times bigger than the continents. And in one sense, that's an enigma, why we have so many more on the continents than we do in the oceans. That's why I was making the point. Read Psalm 147 and 148. And it's because of our very complex and abundant water cycle that we can actually have such an incredible diversity of species in the continental land masses. And there again is a testimony to the creative hand of God. There is a hand over here I was missing. Nope. Okay, must have answered it. Yes.
Oceans versus continents doesn't quite sound like the right division, because there are a lot of species that exist in both, especially at a small species level. So are the 2.2 and the 6.7 separate species, and somehow they're the ones that exist in both places are being counted twice, or what?
No, and the real thing is that those that do live in both environments, they're not counting the prokaryotes, are not that large in number.
They're not.
So they tend to either be strictly ocean or strictly continents. There's just a few that are able to go from one to the other. And, you know, the big animals can. But there's not that many big animals in the list. I mean, in terms of that 8.7 million, 4,000 of them are mammals. So mammals make up just a drop in the bucket. If you want to throw the birds in, which can go to both places, that only adds another 11,000. So, you know, the life on planet Earth that, you know, we tend to think is really important in terms of number of species, not that important at all. On the other hand, I will add this. For Adam and Eve, they were about double the number of bird species and double the number of mammal species. It's because of human abuse that we have so few mammals and so few birds on the planet today. And by the way, today, they're disappearing faster than ever. So, yes.
Was it the PLOS website you're looking for, Sarah?
Okay, the journal is called P, capital L, little O, big S, biology.
.org.
Yeah.
PLOS.org.
Yeah, go to PLOS.biology.org. You'll find the paper. So I was trying to give you the exact name of the paper, but somehow, I know why I didn't. I think I can get it for you. Hang on. I stuck it in the wrong place. Let me see if I can. Okay, I'm going to have to do it this way. Here we go. Oh boy. Righty-righty. See if I can pick it up here. Ah, I got it. It's Camillo Moro et al. The title of the paper is How Many Species Are There on Earth and in the Ocean? And it's August 23rd, 2011. A little farther back than I thought. August 23rd, 2011. So yeah, you can get it right on your smartphone, and you'll probably be able to get the entire article on your smartphone. Because the one thing about that journal is they just give you everything for free. So, including the diagrams. All right.
Question.
Yeah.
Does the eukaryotes and that include plants?
Yeah, the eukaryotes, all plant and animal species are eukaryotes. The prokaryotes, they're exclusively bacteria and archaea. They're all unicellular. Although it is possible for some of the prokaryotes to form what we call bacterial mats, where they'll kind of colonize. But they're all the cells are all the same. They just simply kind of get together with all their buddies and form a little mat out there. So in that sense, you're not dealing with anything that has multicellular capability where the cells are different from one another. All right. Let me see if we can actually finish Psalm 139 today.
We won't let
you do that. Yeah, probably not. Well, I mean, we're getting close. Okay.
Do you have any comments on the shuttle?
Why it took so long to get to the museum? I think one reason why it took so long to get to the museum is that Toyota wanted one of their trucks to actually haul the thing. And it took them a little bit longer than they thought. I mean, I don't know what that's going to come out in the future ads. I think their whole idea is, look, our truck can pull the space shuttle. Yeah, it can pull it if it's empty. So. Right. Yeah, well, I think what's interesting, though, is NASA's decision to go private industry. And so now it's all going to be private industry that's taking stuff up there.
One went off the other day.
One went off the other day to take supplies. And so, free market always beats the government. So, I didn't mean to get political about that, sorry. But it is a biblical principle that free market competition is really the way to go. You see that in the book of Acts, that we're not to worry about the pagans and their temples. What we need to do is promote the Christian faith in an arena of free market competition of ideas. And that's the one thing Christianity has got going for. It's the one and only religion that can survive in an arena of free market competition of ideas. I mean, if you go to an Islamic nation, it's against the law to proselytize a Muslim and take him into another faith. In fact, you can lose your life for doing that in an Islamic country. And by the way, same thing applies in India. They have laws that prevent anyone from converting a Hindu to a different faith. In Christianity, we let people believe what they want. Why? Because we're so confident we have the truth. If you've got a good product, you want a free market competition of ideas, because your product, it will obviously show its quality over the competition. And likewise, what you see in Genesis chapter 9, 10 and 11 is God setting up a free market competition of nations competing with one another for citizens. And that's a prescription to prevent nations from getting unduly oppressive towards their citizens. And we live in a nation that has benefited from the fact that we offer less oppression of our citizens than other nations. And so many people have left the nations around the world and have come here because of the fact that we've set up a national system that is less oppressive. I'm not saying our system isn't oppressive, just less oppressive than what you see elsewhere. And God's whole point is, don't be surprised if the leaders of nations begin to exercise selfish motives. That's just kind of the way people are. And so if you only have one nation, it will quickly evolve to being extremely oppressive of its citizens. But back there in Genesis 9 and 10 and 11, God sets up a system where people live in nations that freely compete with one another for citizens. At least that's the ideal. So anyway, we're wrapping up our section on human the idea of God creating humanity with a discussion of junk DNA. And just like we've been talking about trying to explain why our planet has so many species, another way of testing competing creation evolution models is to look at the DNA. Now let me just give you some historical background here. When you look at the human genome, only 2% of that genome codes for proteins. And for a long time, geneticists have concluded that the remaining 98% is the accumulated junk from hundreds of millions of years of evolution. And so if you believe that human beings are the product of common descent, and that we evolved from species that predated us, and those species will be subject to genetic decay, by the way, that is a true principle. All species of life, once they're created, will decay as a direct result of what you see in Romans 8. The entire creation is subject to the law of decay. And so the human genome is in a state of decay. And I think you could argue that we are visibly showing evidences of genetic decay that weren't there 2, 3, 4, 5,000 years ago. For no other reason, just look at how big the percentage of people suffering from diabetes is compared to, say, even 100 years ago. And, that's just a direct result of the fact that our genome, like the genomes of all species, is subject to genetic decay. Now, if we're the product of natural descent, where our genome has come from species that have preceded us, a common ancestor with a chimpanzee, for example, where that chimpanzee is a common ancestor of what do they call these little tiny primates?
Lemurs.
Yeah, they're common ancestor of the lemurs, and that common ancestor is a common ancestor of another species, and so on all the way back to the first life form, then you'd be predicting that the human genome would have more junky DNA in it than any other species of life. Why? because we're the last created. Since we're the last species to show up on the scene, from an evolutionary perspective, we should have the most junk. And indeed, 30 years ago, when they looked at our genome, they said, it looks like it's 98% junk. Now, if you've been subscribing to Today's New Reason to Believe and our podcast through one of your smartphones, if you don't have the Reasons to Believe app, it's free. You can download it for free. That will give you access to this. About 2.5 weeks ago, the ENCODE project published their results. And Fuzz Rana, our staff biochemist, jumped all over that. I think he's got 3 podcasts on that already, as well as 2 articles. You can read that. But basically what the ENCODE project did is revise the figure of 2% of the human genome having function to more than 80% of the human genome having function. And what's interesting, too, about the research team that published this is they were caught off guard by all the creationists that picked up on this and said, see, we were right all along. And they basically tried to backpedal and said, well, we weren't really saying that this was designed with a purpose. Actually, what they did say, we're not saying that 80% of the genome is designed. We're saying 80% of the genome has purpose and function. Well, technically, that's the same thing. It's just semantics. Actually worse. And that's what Fuzz wound up doing, is doing a podcast and publishing an article saying, well, you know, their attempt to backpedal because they were so stunned by what the creationists did when this thing got published actually makes the case for the biblical creator stronger, not weaker. A couple of hands. Ross, you're first.
You've been saying this for years. So what did that project say that was new?
It didn't really say anything new. That's one thing Fuzz said in his podcast. Look, we've been publishing this for years, that it's not 2%. It's much higher than that. In fact, our figure is way higher than 80%. But what thrilled us about the ENCODE project is that they demonstrated the biblical principle that divine design isn't always in the region of purpose that you're looking for. And the problem here was people thought that the genome was only there to have the blueprints for how you put together the proteins. That was the only function of the any genome. Now, for some organisms, that's a big chunk of their genome. It's simply giving the blueprints for the proteins. In the case of the human genome, that only accounts for 2%. So what the ENCODE project people were saying is there's a lot more function and purpose going on in the human genome besides providing the blueprints for proteins. And it's something we've already said here in class. It's something you see in Psalm 139, that you know, God created us human beings and designed us to be able to develop from the time of birth into something much greater than we're capable of at birth. And that's where a lot of our genome comes into play, is providing the structure to make sure that our development follows the design that God intended.
So are they still saying that 20% of it then is junk?
Well, they're a little more cautious than that. They're saying we've gone from 2% to 80%. Maybe there's something going on in that 20% that we're not looking for yet. And so that was a positive thing they made note of. Because after all, I mean, picking up an extra 78% isn't trivial. Maybe it's going to go all the way to 99%+. We'll see. Okay, you were next. Yes.
Well, I'm just thinking in their statement they should include the word known, that 80% is known to have function, and that these prior figures actually just reveal profound ignorance about the extreme sophistication.
Well, that's kind of the biblical principle, is that the more you look for God's handiwork, the more you'll discover God's handiwork. And don't be surprised if a lot of God's handiwork is hidden from your view because you're simply not looking in the right places. You know, kind of like looking for your kids' toys in your house. I mean, you got to be fairly thorough to find them, yes.
Did they describe the kinds of functions? Did they describe any of that?
Yes, they did. And well, I mean, basically they're saying the same thing we've been saying for years. I mean, in fact, I was just going to take you through the different kinds of function we see inside the human genome. And there's basically five categories of function that we've found so far. There may be more that we haven't yet discovered. But so kind of what I want to do is take you through step by step as to why the evolutionists weren't seeing the function and where it really does reside. But it kind of ties in with the discovery we see here in astrobiology. And, you know, one thing I want to emphasize about human beings compared to all other life, you know, you go to the hospital, you have a baby, and the baby comes out of the mother's womb. The thing that's unique about human beings is that that baby coming out of the mother's womb is really different from the adult you're going to see at 24 years of age. And whereas with other animals, I mean, if you watch, you know, National Geographic or Discovery Channel documentaries on television, you know, the giraffe gives birth to a baby giraffe, and the giraffe within a few minutes can stand and run. That's not true of a human baby. It's not capable of running. In fact, it's not even capable of holding its head up. And you know, the human species stands alone and you know, having this tremendous degree of development between the time of being born and to the time of it being fully functional. And also with humans, that newborn baby needs more care than any other species of life we see. You see birds feeding their young. You see, you know, mammals nursing their young. But in the case of humans, the degree of parental care that's involved is far beyond we see in any other species. But likewise, we shouldn't be surprised that a big chunk of our genome is governing the development of that child from the time of conception, because a lot of development takes place in those 9 months in the womb. And there's DNA that determines how that proceeds. And then once it's out of the womb, DNA kicks in to govern what takes place in the next 23 years if you're a woman, 24 years if you're a man. It's not surprising that we men take longer to develop, right? Yes.
During those 9 months, a fetus, doesn't it have a tail and then the tail disappears or something? I mean, is that true?
Okay, you'll see this in a lot of evolutionary textbooks. If you look at the embryos, it looks like, you know, they have similarities. I'll talk about the fact that we have gills were in the womb.
Right.
There's this tail structure were in the womb. And therefore, we must have a common ancestor.
Exactly.
We must have a common, you know, we came out of the sea. We know the Earth at one time didn't have continents. So the first life forms were marine life forms. And we shouldn't be surprised that we have these gill structures that show up inside the embryo. Well, it's a classic case of not looking deep enough at the structure of the embryo. I mean, it kind of looks like a gill, looks like a tail, but it's an entirely different function. And so the textbooks are now being changed on that manner. So yeah, you and I went to school and got high school biology decades ago. And just now the textbooks are beginning to catch up with the fact that, yeah, if you use a low-resolution telescope, it looks like these embryos of animals are all similar. But if you use high-resolution instrumentation and actually begin to look at what's really going on in those structures, we're clear that we made a mistake in identifying it as, quote, gills. Yes?
How could Darwinian evolution ever explain the differences in people's faces compared to any other species at all?
Well, that is important. It's like, you know, God seemed to anticipate that there would be 7 billion of us. And, you know, how is it that we're able to recognize one person out of those 7 billion and know exactly who we're talking to? And it's not just that our faces are distinct. It's that there's stuff in the genome that gives us the capability to recognize tiny differences of the faces. And, you know, because sometimes I've noticed with animals, with our pets, they obviously have a much harder time looking at us and figuring out who we are. So we seem to have this ability. Now, of course, animals share this. You know, we look at penguins, they all look the same, right? But you can have thousands of penguins living together in a colony in Antarctica, and they seem to know who's who. It's just that they're trained to pick out subtle features that we don't see. But likewise, we human beings are trained to pick up subtle features that other animals can't see. But you are right. I mean, we look at penguins, they really do kind of all look the same. But human beings, we're critically different. We're different heights, different skin color, different hair color. The faces look radically different, and particularly the eyes and the eyebrows about the eyes, the depth of the eye sockets. And they've done studies on that. In terms of facial recognition, the eyes are really critical. That what they, you know, they've done experiments where they block out the eyes, and people have a much harder time picking out who's who. And yet, you know, our eyes aren't that different. There's something about the way we human beings are designed that we can somehow, you know, use that eyes to make contact. Yeah.
So on 60 Minutes, they had a program where there are a few people who can't recognize faces.
Yeah, and they've been able to identify it's a genetic defect that makes them unable to recognize differences in the eyes.
When they show the pictures of people who, they just show the picture, their face upside down, and the person could not recognize their own child.
Right,
right. And a lot of it has to do with connection. I mean, for example, I'm looking at you right now, and we're making eye-to-eye contact. When you make eye-to-eye contact, the facial expression changes, and that immediately tells you whether you're dealing with a stranger or someone that knows you. Now, one reason why this works, and I wrote on this like 25 years ago, is because one of the things that's unique about the human eye is we have a lot of white in our eyes. You know that whole phrase, don't shoot until you see the white of their eyes? Well, because we have a lot of white that goes with our eyes, you can tell where the eyes are looking. And you can tell what the eyes are focusing on, whether focusing on something near or far away. So the fact that we can look at people's eyes, I mean, right away a communication begins because you can directionally tell where they're looking. And the amazing thing is, I can see the whites of all of your eyes. I mean, this is a big room, right? The very fact that I can make contact with someone's eyes across the room, look at the whites of his eyes, figure out where he's looking, figure out what he's focusing on, and therefore whether there's recognition going on or not. We're the one species that can do that. Because you look at my dog, I don't see any whites, just that whole iris and pupil fills the entire eye, and it's really hard to tell which direction that dog is looking. Unless I get really close, then I can tell. So that's the wonderful thing about human beings. It makes it possible for us to network in a big business meeting, right? You walk into a hall and there's 1,000 people there, and you can pick someone out in that hall because of the fact that you can see the whites of the eyes of 1,000 people in one room. It only works with human beings. It doesn't work with any other species. God seemed to know that we'd have to go to these conferences and be able to communicate, yes.
Does this mean dementia's coming in pretty soon? Because I went up to a guy at Starbucks, elderly man, and I said, hey, how you doing? How are you? It's been a what you been up to? I said, oh, boy, I don't know you. And it was actually somebody else, I thought it was. He had a kind of a similar look. And, I mean, there is a distinct difference when you put them together. So what made me do that?
Well, haven't we all done that where you kind of, you know, pick out someone and says, oh, yeah, that's my friend so-and-so. Then you realize you're mistaken.
Right.
You know, it doesn't work perfectly.
Oh.
However, it's amazing how well it works. I mean, you can probably count on two hands the number of times you misidentified someone in the last year.
Well, it's interesting. People confuse me with Brad Pitt.
Doesn't happen to me. So.
Is that what you do at the Braille Institute?
You walked into that one. So.
I knew you were good.
Yeah, you're setting them up with a straight line, right? Yeah, there you go. So. Well, back to the ZenCode project. What we're now discovering is how much of the genome, rather than giving a blueprint for the proteins, actually controls when the proteins are to be built, where they're to be used, where the different body structures go. And I think I mentioned this the last time I was here. A scientist that we're recruiting to bring on to the Reasons to Believe research team, Katie Galloway at Caltech, said this in her thesis defense. It is extremely challenging to explain the origin and operation and complexity, which is that 2%. You know, the blueprint that shows you how this complex protein is put together. But then she followed up with this one. It is far more difficult yet to explain the origin and operation of the control systems that manage the complexity. And that's where a huge amount of our DNA is going. That's what the ENCODE project was basically bringing out, is that how much of our genome is basically dealing with the control of the complexity rather than giving the blueprints for the complexity. And indeed, I think Katie's got a point. As difficult as it is for the evolutionists to explain the origin of the complexity, far more challenging yet is trying to explain what is it that controls the complexity, determining when it kicks in and when it doesn't kick in, and where it kicks in and where it doesn't kick in. And if you look at the human body, it's an incredibly complex system, and different parts go in different directions. Aren't you glad that the lungs are in the right place and the right size? And interacting with the heart in the right way. What if they were down by your feet? Wouldn't that cause a problem? So you're telling me I'm out of time. So next week, we're going to talk about 2 weeks from today. I'm going to actually be back in Charlotte, North Carolina next Sunday. But we're going to talk about the pseudogenes, the signs, the lines. Those are acronyms. You got to have acronyms in science. Science can't operate without acronyms. Endogenous retroviruses and LTRs. This is the 98%. And what we're discovering is that 98% has not just five different functions, but many more different functions, and probably more functions we're not yet seeing again. And I think what's most interesting, and Fuzz could speak to you about this, you can read his articles, is that we look at these different components, what we used to call junk DNA, it's not just serving one purpose, of multiple purposes. And that truly is a signature of the handiwork of God. Just like when you read a Bible chapter, it doesn't have just one message, but multiple messages. Likewise, we're seeing the DNA. It has multiple purposes, not just one purpose. It can actually do two or three things at once. We'll get to that 2 weeks from today. Let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we do thank you, as it says in Psalm 139, that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. That the more we examine the human body, the more we examine the genome that controls the buildup of the human body from the time of conception to the time we reach full adulthood and even on beyond then, the more amazingly, wonderfully designed we see that you have put us together, that we are indeed the peak of your creation. Of all life we see in planet Earth, we are the ones that exhibit the handiwork of God more than any other. Not just at the physical level, but the soulish and spiritual level as well. Thank you, Lord, for the privilege of living in the 21st century when our scientific community is uncovering so much more of your handiwork and the care and the meticulous nature in which you've put us together. Indeed, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And may we give you all the glory and the honor for the fearful, wonderful design we see within each one of us. In Jesus' name, amen.